The Trend on WNIN-FM. Good afternoon. I'm John Gibson. Over the next few weeks on the program, we'll be talking about the findings of the recently released Tri-State Health Survey, funded by the Welborn Baptist Foundation. There are some serious and wide-reaching public policy implications in the survey, as well as information we can all use to hopefully improve our health. Today, we'll start with an overview of the survey's findings, and then later dive into our first topic of the survey, adult and childhood obesity. Our first guest today is Elizabeth Tharp, Evaluation and Research Officer from the Welborn Baptist Foundation. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, John.
We certainly appreciate it. Feel free to get cozy with that microphone there. Well, let's start with a broad look at the survey here. Essentially, what do you do there? What is the sample size, the methodology of this survey?
Sure. Well, the Tri-State Health Survey is a broad survey, actually covers seven counties in the tri-state area. In Indiana, that's Vandenberg, Warwick, Gibson, and Vandenberg, Warwick, DuBois, Spencer, and Gibson in Indiana, mm-hmm. Saline County in Illinois, and Henderson County in Kentucky. And data was collected in this last round over a few months in about the second quarter of 2014. Mm-hmm. And over 4,300 adults actually provided survey data on a variety of health issues, health topics, and health-related behaviors. They also provided data on close to 900 children in their homes. Mm-hmm. So we have some data on children, too.
So both adults and children.
Absolutely.
This was a telephone survey?
It was a telephone survey. It was a random sample of these adults, and it was a random sample of landlines, cell phones, and prepaid cell phones.
I see.
Yes.
And so, let's get into some of the areas here. It looks like the results of the survey show top three, I guess you could say, the top three mm-hmm. problems in this area. Can you go down those and describe those problems?
Sure. As you said, there were definitely some things that rose to the top in terms of concern in the area of chronic disease and various health conditions. Mm-hmm. Arthritis is one of those. In the survey, we found that one out of every three tri-state adults reports a diagnosis of arthritis, and that includes things like osteoarthritis, lupus, fibromyalgia, and the like. The second issue that really rose to the top was high blood pressure. So four out of every 10 adults, or approaching 40%, in other words, of adults in the area said they have high blood pressure. They've been officially diagnosed by a healthcare professional. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a bit higher than the states and the nation as well. And then mental health issues really rose to the top here. One out of every four adults said they have been diagnosed officially with depression at some point, and nearly the same with anxiety, about one out of every four.
You mentioned high blood pressure. How does arthritis, high blood pressure, mental health here in our area, how does it compare to the rest of the nation? Mm-hmm. How unusually high are these issues?
In some cases, much higher. The full report, of course, we do direct comparisons with state and national data. And so mm-hmm. I do encourage listeners to go to the full report, which I'm sure will tell them how to get there.
Sure.
And really dig down and look at those comparisons. But suffice it to say that in each of those three areas, rates were significantly higher than states and nation.
And as far as the rest of the state, I mean, do you mm-hmm. see a bigger gap between us and the rest of the state, or more of a gap between us and the United States?
I would venture to say more of a gap between us and the United States. And one thing that folks that look at a lot of data quickly realize is our tri-state counties, these counties that kind of border along the Ohio and the Wabash Rivers and mm-hmm. Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky, we're more like each other than we are like our states in a lot of cases. So, for example, some of the indicators in our southeastern Illinois counties are similar to southwestern Indiana counties.
Right.
But if you look at those Illinois counties compared to the state of Illinois, it's quite, they're very different. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to say is state data doesn't always represent what's going on in the tri-state.
Sure.
It's really important to do these regional studies right here in this area like this.
I know I've talked to state legislators who talk mm-hmm. about Indiana dividing it into three, actually. There's Southern Indiana, there's Central Indiana, and there's Northern Indiana.
Exactly.
And some very vast cultural differences in all three.
Yes.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Tharp. She's the Evaluation and Research Officer for the Welborn Baptist Foundation. We're talking about the new Tri-State Health Survey. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 812-426-7400. That's 812-426-7400 here at WNIN-FM. Now, you mentioned the top three problems. I noticed there's also an area here where you've come up with three areas for improvement. Essentially, how did you come to that idea?
Sure. So there's actually a couple of things. There's areas where we seem to be doing some things well, and then there's some behaviors or choices that that represent really good opportunities for improving our health. Would you like me to speak to both of those, Sean?
Well, sure. What is the as you say, there are areas of improvement as opposed to problems. And
exactly.
So go right ahead.
Sure. So we're actually doing better if we compare ourselves to the nation in areas like routine checkups, getting our well checks every year, in getting eye exams, routine eye exams, dental checkups, as well as just having an identified healthcare provider who we consider our personal provider, as opposed to going to an emergency room, you know, for regular care, that we have that personal health care provider we can call. And so there's some preventative things that we seem to be doing that are very positive.
So we seem to be getting the checkups and making it to the doctor's office and all that kind of thing.
That's what these, 4,300 adults indicated, that they are going to the doctor annually, and we're doing those things more than adults in the nation when we compare ourselves to the nation. And in addition, we're getting recommended screenings for certain cancers. Some of the top cancers in the tri-state, like prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, we're getting those recommended screenings. So that's a very positive thing as well.
So I guess the question has to come to mind, if we're doing that, those kinds of things, the preventive things, why are we not seeing better results in, say, like those three problems you were just talking about?
Excellent question. Yes, that is what comes to most people's mind when they see these results. And, I think the answer to that is complex, but one of the things that we really have to look at is our preventable risk factors. So these are the areas that represent our best opportunity, really, in order to improve health. And that's with our weight, with our nutrition, the things we're eating, smoking, cigarette smoking, and substance use, in particular alcohol consumption.
How do we rank in terms of things like smoking and alcohol? Are we higher than the national average?
We are. Let's take smoking for example. We are seeing improvements. We definitely are across the nation and in the tri-state as well. But still, about a quarter of us, about one out of every four, still smoke cigarettes. And in the nation, I think it's now maybe around 17% or something like that. So we're still higher, although we are seeing some improvements, and that's a good thing.
You mentioned nutrition as well. Are we essentially eating a lot of bad stuff?
Well, yes, and I know that sometimes gets some flack, in the public. It's not about telling anyone what they can eat and what they can't, but every choice we make has a consequence, and it's not to say that all foods are, that there's bad foods or there's good foods. That's not what it's about, but there are consequences to, let's say, a diet that's very high in sugar, or a diet that's very high in fat. There's consequences to that, in terms of our health, and so in the tri-state, we consume less produce, fresh produce, compared to the nation. We also have some food access issues. About one out of every four adults in the survey said that they really want to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables, but have obstacles such as cost, transportation, and the quality of the produce at their vendor.
Yes, it seems I hear that quite a bit, that the idea of eating a more healthy diet is unfortunately more expensive, and a lot of folks can't afford it. Is that something you hear?
It is something that we hear, and I know that there's lots of strategies of trying to change that and trying to educate the public on how to eat healthier and make it fit into a budget. So it is possible, it can be done, but there is a mindset out there for sure that it's unattainable because it's going to cost too much.
Yeah. We're speaking with Elizabeth Tharp. She's the Evaluation and Research Officer for the Welborn Baptist Foundation. The foundation recently released the new Tri-State Health Survey. As I understand it, it's a survey you folks do about once every 5 years?
That's correct.
All right. Well, something that jumped out at me as I was looking at the survey, we mentioned unhealthy weight. And these numbers, 1 of 3 adults, 1 of 5 children, and 1 of 3 preschool children are obese, not just overweight, but considered obese. Mm-hmm. That's pretty shocking.
It is very shocking. And I think the adult data is perhaps less shocking because we've heard this a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. here and there in different studies that our obese rates are a little bit higher than certain areas of the country. But still, it's not good. It's not good news. Right. But with children, we don't have a lot of good data out there. And so this is, I think, rather surprising. So if we look at all the children overall, the close to 900 children that data was collected on, it's about 35% of the total is either overweight or obese. And so then you look at those age breakdowns, and it's even more concerning. Yeah.
And I know you may not have all the answers to this, but as far as those guidelines, I mean, mm-hmm. what's considered overweight, what's considered obese, what sort of scale do you follow on that?
It's called the Body Mass Index, and there's an adult version and a children's version. And basically, there's more science behind it than I'm gonna be able to explain, mm-hmm. but I can tell you it's a calculation based on height and weight, and then with children it's even a little bit more complex than that.
Your survey in terms of preschool children mm-hmm. being obese, how does that happen exactly? I guess in my mind, you know, you buy the baby food, you know, that kind of thing, but. How are these young children getting so overweight?
Yeah, it's a question that people around the country are asking themselves because we're seeing it's not just here, we're seeing preschool obesity mm-hmm. rates increasing, which is just very unfortunate. So it, you know, there's has something to do with. I'm presuming there's some physical activity factors in there. There's some diet, nutrition factors that are going into this, but yeah, it's pretty alarming.
So what is someone who is obese, what do we do with this information?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I would say is not, you know, we don't need as a community to be discouraged by this. We've seen in the headlines over the years some of these titles and things that, you know, we're an obese area or maybe most obese city and
right,
all of
the
these things.
The fattest city in the country, yes.
Right, which that's not a study that I go to gauge how we're doing in this community. I'm looking at several data sources. I don't find support for that title. Mm-hmm. But having said that, there's still obviously some concern here. And so the first thing I would say is just let's not be discouraged by this data, but just start really considering, just be aware of it and be considering how important this is to us as individuals and as a community and why it should be important. It's not about telling people what to do or what not to do, but it's about our collective health. It's about our own health, our loved ones' health. And at the end of the day, obesity is linked to chronic disease. Right. The adults in our study, obese adults were 5 times more likely to have diabetes, 4 times more likely to have heart disease, and the list goes on and on and on with chronic diseases and conditions. So it's about quality of life.
Right.
And so, you know, just that awareness is a first step. And, you know, as communities, there's individual level choices we can make to improve our health, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of physical activity and nutrition. But there's system level changes that need to take place too to support those changes. So go ahead.
I was just going to ask. So what does the community do with this information? I mean, and in fact, is it being distributed to the community?
Sure.
Are our elected leaders and medical leaders all looking over this data?
Sure. I hope so. We certainly want to make this available and accessible to everyone who can use it. And, you know, we as a foundation, this is a priority area for us that we do a lot of work in, not only writing checks, you know, for grants in these areas, but also we have in-house folks, some great initiatives that, like Heroes, it's a school-based health program that's working in the schools to change school culture and make physical activity and better nutrition easier for our children while they're at school. That's just an example. But there's a lot of things that we're doing in our community at large. Our hospitals, you know, they do community health needs assessments every so often. They're part of collaborative conversations. You know, there's a lot of folks behind the scenes that are getting together and working more collectively on these issues, right. which is a very much needed to change the course of this.
If things go as planned, there will be an IU medical school locating in downtown Evansville.
That's right.
Will you be sharing this information with those folks? Do you see that as a positive, development in terms of healthcare in this area?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that there's tremendous potential, and we're all excited to see exactly how this plays out and what kind of work we can all do together in terms of our health in the community. Sure.
Yeah. Now, what's the takeaway for you on the survey, generally speaking?
I'm not surprised about some aspects. I am pretty alarmed about others.
What surprised you the most?
I think surprised me the most was probably the substance abuse data, the alcohol consumption data. We binge drink in the tri-state at double the rate of adults across the nation, and I think that was probably the most alarming statistic for me.
And you also mentioned mental health being a problem.
Yes.
You know, how do we get to the root of that? Why is there so much in the way of mental health issues in our area?
You know, I know there's a lot of minds working on that as well, trying to figure that out. And I'm happy that our survey has brought some of those issues to light. And I've gotten lots of calls and had some other interviews and different things about that very issue. And I think that we really need to be paying attention to the links between substance use and mental health. For example, there's higher than average suicide rates in our area and things of that nature too. So it's definitely an issue that's a burning platform in our community that we really need to address.
And do you get indications in your data that that mental health, feeds the problem, and pardon the pun, of obesity and that kind of thing? Or is it the other way around? How are some of these things connected?
That's a very good question. We know that there's some kind of relationship. However, what causes the other, we're not able to see that. But in this survey, we are able to see that folks who are obese are more likely to report poor mental health. More likely to report, as I mentioned, different chronic diseases and conditions, and just overall poorer physical health. So we know that those things are, there's a relationship there in some way. Which causes the other, I'm not sure. Certainly if we can impact one or the other, I would hope that it would have a positive impact on that relationship.
So if folks want to see this survey themselves, they can go online. Can you give us that that URL?
They sure can. Yes, we have a home for data. We have it's called the Tri-State Community Wellness Indicators Online. And that website is tristatecwi.org. So it's tristatecwi.org. And there they can find a variety. They can find our past surveys as well as this current survey, and they can find secondary level community data from broad sources on cancer prevalence and heart disease prevalence and things like that too. So that will help provide folks a nice range of data from this primary self-report data of the Tri-State Health Survey, but then the secondary data on that site as well.
So they can check out the data. How can they become involved? What can they do?
Sure. Stay tuned with the foundation to see kind of what's going on. We have a Facebook page. I invite folks to like it and for updates and news and how to get connected with different things. There is a great collaboration that is working in and developing kind of its strategies to address some of these things in the community. It's called Healthy Communities Partnership. And I believe that link is on our foundation page, but they can go to healthybyfive.org and find more information about that. And as time goes on and as this collaborative develops, there will be more and more ways that the community can get involved.
Yeah. Elizabeth Tharp, Evaluation and Research Officer for Welburn Baptist Foundation. We certainly appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We're talking about the recently released Tri-State Health Survey. It was funded by the Welburn Baptist Foundation. And coming up next on The Trend, we will have three Evansville area doctors joining the conversation. We hope you will stay tuned. I'm John Gibson. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM.
It's still cold outside, but we're thinking spring. The 42nd annual Channel 9 Spring Auction, the station's televised live auction fundraiser, is April 20th through 26th. If you or your business would like to donate an item to the televised auction, please contact Nikki at 812-423-2973 or events at WNIN.org to donate. Support for WNIN-FM comes in part through a grant from Trailer Brothers Incorporated, who invite you to join them in support of public radio.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Today, we're talking about the Tri-State Health Survey. It was recently released by the Welburn Baptist Foundation, talking about many health issues that the Tri-State is facing. And joining us now are three area doctors. First of all, let's welcome Dr. Laura Becker. We appreciate you coming in. Dr. Becker is... you specialize, as I understand it, in hormonal effects and behavior, correct?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Also joining us today, Dr. Patel Dovla-Tabadi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. She's from the University of Evansville. As I understand it, you special in nutrition, chronic disease prevention, and mental health. And also joining us today, Dr. James Schrader. You're a pediatric psychologist, correct?
That's correct. Thank you.
I appreciate you all coming in today. Well, we're tackling obesity. That seems to be one of the main issues that's shown up here in the Tri-State Health Survey. Well, let's start with mental issues. Dr. Dovla-Tabadi, can you tell us what mental health issues are related to obesity?
Yes, obesity, some risk factors for obesity are socioeconomic status, and as a result, obesity can cause a number of mental health-related issues such as depression, anxiety disorders, along with many others. It can create suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. So alongside the other health-related issues, there are significant mental issues involved as well.
Now, I got into this a little bit with our earlier guest about, the cause and effect, are you depressed that causes obesity, or is it the obesity that causes depression? It sounds like it could be an endless cycle.
Yes, definitely. And it can be vice versa. Depression is actually a risk factor for obesity. Being depressed and having that imbalance in neurotransmitters can cause you to eat more and eat more of junky foods. But being obese and wanting to change that behavior, engage in behavioral change, and wanting to get out of that lifestyle can engage in depression as well, because it's very difficult for a person who is obese to change behavioral patterns.
And speaking of behavior, Dr. Laura Becker, as I understand it, you specialize in hormonal effects on behavior. How do we get to that? How do we get to behavior change to more healthy habits?
It's really a large challenge because so much of what we do is reinforced to eat. We used to be a nomadic nation and travel all around, and when we saw food, we ate it. Mm-hmm. And now we have food everywhere we look. If you have some change in your pocket, you can get a candy bar. So the idea is to try to help people understand that just because they see food, they don't need to eat it, even though everything in their body is saying it's there. We should have it. So right. Changing our thoughts towards food, not as a survival mechanism anymore, but as just a resource that we need to manage.
And in terms of talking about depression and its relationship to obesity, Do we see a trend where food is just seen as perhaps one's only pleasure, that people eat because it's fun to do, it feels good, it tastes good, what have you. And perhaps, you know, if you're generally depressed, that's one way of finding happiness, right?
Certainly. One of the foods that we get rewarded for the most in our brain is sugar. Mm-hmm. And so most of our comfort foods are based in carbohydrates and a source of that sugar for the brain, so that we do get a huge reward back for eating a cheesecake.
Yeah, right. We'll be adding Dr. James Schrader to the discussion here in just a moment. But I understand we have our very own Cass Harrington on the line here. She was going to be hosting the show today. She was called away, but I believe we've got her on the line. Cass, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon.
I might lose you, so I'll get my question out very quickly. This is for Dr. Dovlata Body, and anyone else really can chime in. But I've spoken with people who work in the healthcare industry, and a lot of times they're seeing patients, not just obese, but, I mean, talking about 300, sometimes 400 pounds. And with, you know, I want to frame this respectfully, but, you know, how does somebody get to that much weight? It doesn't happen overnight, and I'm sure too there are probably some misunderstandings or kind of misperceptions about people who are that heavy.
Right. Is that the morbidly obese? Is that the expression we would use, Dr.?
Yes, that is correct. If someone does weigh 300 or 400 pounds, they are considered morbid obese. And it's important to remember that obesity does have a genetic component as well. Although the number of obesity cases that do have a genetic component are very low, about 2 to 3%. And typically when we see someone who is morbid obese, generally as a population, we think that, oh, it's your fault because you're obese. It's your behavior, therefore it's your fault, but that's really incorrect. Obesity is not your fault. Food these days are processed. Most foods in the grocery store, 90% are actually processed and have some sort of genetically modified ingredient. Mm-hmm. Therefore, nowadays, it's seeming like food is becoming more of an addiction. Therefore, it's actually not their fault, but rather food is becoming more and more addicted. We have high levels of salts, high levels of fats, high levels of sugars, and this is all contributing mm-hmm. to the obesity epidemic.
Some people might find that surprising. You're saying that because quite often you might see overweight parents have overweight children, mm-hmm. and so you think it's genetic, but you're saying it's just a very tiny percentage are actually genetic?
Yes. Most research studies have shown that only 2 to 3% of obesity cases have a genetic component, and one study actually revealed a few months ago that our children will not outlive their parents. That is to the extent the obesity epidemic is taking.
And so is it more of a, obviously, it's more of a case of just bad habits being passed on to their
Absolutely.
Children?
Absolutely. Bad habits, behavior. Therefore, the behavioral change needs to begin with the parents so that they can teach that to their children.
All right. Cass, are you still with us? All right. I believe we've lost Cass now. We certainly appreciate her call. And, of course, you at home can join the conversation. The number is 812-426-7400. That will get you here to the WNIN-FM studio, 426-7400. We're talking about the latest Tri-State Health Survey, and in particularly obesity, which, of course, is a major issue raised in that survey. Dr. James Schrader, we appreciate you joining the conversation here. You're a pediatric psychologist. We were talking earlier some rather shocking numbers, I thought, that one out of three, I believe it is, one out of three preschool children is considered obese. How did we get to that point?
It is pretty amazing. And you talk about the food and the makeup of food today. I think that is a big issue there. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it looks at, you describe the habits and the habits that we have as families. One of the things that I think that parents aren't aware of is that when we go to introduce foods very early on, many times we think that if a child doesn't eat it within 2 to 3 introductions, they aren't going to eat it or they're not going to like it. What we find is actually taste buds take a lot to develop. And mm-hmm. so oftentimes it may take 15 to 20 times or more of an introduction of a food for that child to actually begin to be used to eating that food. But I think for many parents, and I hear this often in the office, once they don't feel like there's an initial positive reaction, they move on to other foods. And unfortunately, those are often the foods that are very high in fat and salt mm-hmm. content. Many kids over and over will eat chicken nuggets or something in the similar variety, mm-hmm. but won't eat anything that's produce related. So that's a big piece.
And so are you saying that parents should be more persistent, have more patience in terms of getting children to eat healthier foods?
Absolutely. I think what we really like to do, and many would support the idea, is that we embed new foods with foods that are already existing that they will eat. And so we certainly don't want to have a meal where all the foods are new or difficult to eat, but we want to embed small samples, small portions of foods that we are trying to introduce, especially, again, fruits and vegetables in those areas.
Right. So a gradual approach. Works better.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Becker, again, you specialize in behavior. Is that an approach that you see works better in terms of getting young people to eat fruits, vegetables, and maybe less sugar and fat?
Yes, we need to watch how busy our lives are, because taking the time with our children to introduce the proper food slowly takes away from our rushed, busy life. And we also don't want to have a argument every meal. And so we'll ask children what they want to eat. They don't really know. They don't have the whole vocabulary of what they want to eat. Mm-hmm. So spend less time asking them what they want and saying, hey, let's try it.
Right, right. And as you say, time, I'm sure, is a factor for a lot of folks. People are busy. They're rushing around. Obviously, it's quick and easy to go through the drive-through and get some chicken nuggets rather than perhaps a half hour, an hour at home fixing up a meal. How do we address that issue, those problems?
There are a lot of good food choices that are quick and easy. We just don't think of them. Mm-hmm. Carrots. Carrots are sweet. They are easy to eat. Kids who are not using utensils can use their hands. And just encouraging them into those types of finger foods gets them started.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind me, one more addition, I think, is that there's a huge issue of the types of drinks that our kids are consuming at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
We know that most kids we need water, obviously. That should be the primary, not a secondary source of hydration.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, so many kids today are drinking sodas as a regular habit. Or we've even known more and more now that although fruit drinks in a small portion can be okay, too much apple juice, too much orange juice, again, has high sugar content. And so really today, I think if we were going to reinforce positive habits, it's also around introducing and maintaining water, especially as the primary consumption.
Right.
And also going off of that, average daily sugar consumption should be 40 grams or less, but the average child is consuming over 100 grams of sugar. That just goes to show you that sugar is a huge component in the obesity crisis.
And I know I worked for a brief time recently in a grocery store, and the amount of soda that is sold is really amazing. And as you say, often two children and often the sugary drinks. There seems to be a debate that goes back and forth while we're talking about soda, about diet sodas, calorie-free sodas, and that those somehow are just as bad for you as the sugary ones. Perhaps you'd like to weigh in on that a little bit, Dr. Schrader. I mean, as a diabetic, I can tell you that obviously diet sodas are much better than sugary ones.
Right.
But in general, for children, what's
well, and it's certainly not my primary area of expertise. But what I will say is that if everything we drink has to be sweet, then it really sets the standard for the rest of what we eat and consume in general. And so I'm sure my colleagues here would have better information around that area. But again, if we can't consume water on a regular basis, and I have many kids who just tell me I can't drink it, I just don't like it, then it does set the stage for needing to have that constant reinforcement of a very sweet factor there. So
artificial sweeteners can lead to more sugary substances.
Absolutely. Diet sodas, typically the main ingredient is aspartame. And aspartame is known to have very debilitating health effects. But aspartame can also increase your risk of obesity because it actually fools the body into thinking that it's real sugar. And therefore, it can decrease the amount of leptin that is produced by the body, increasing the risk of obesity. So again, regular sodas, diet sodas, same effect.
Same effect.
Similar effects.
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Becker, in your research on behavior and such, how big of a problem is soda? You go to the grocery store, it's amazing how much soda you see on the shelves. Is there any way to change those habits, those behaviors?
It's interesting because over the years, that has become our drink instead of water or tea or something like that. Sometimes I go to the restaurant and see people feeding soda to their two-year-old child and not realizing there's also caffeine in there.
Right.
And you're wiring the brain with a stimulant on board, and that's going to hurt also. Our taste buds don't know the difference, really, between aspartame and refined sugar, so the brain gets that same reward as before. Start working them into a water, or at least maybe a lightly fruit-flavored water, and then back to natural water, maybe making sure the water's colder to take out some more of the taste components of it, ice water.
Yeah, the ice water does seem to be more popular than just straight from the tap, doesn't it? Also, bottled water, I know a lot of folks, again, we can get into lots of issues here, but Dr. DeLotabadi, bottled water, how does it, you know, how does it compare to the tap?
There have been a number of studies that have shown that bottled water, Dasani, Aquafina, any type of bottled water really is 40 to 60% tap water. So it does primarily have the same ingredients. It may, there may be some sort of filtration with bottled water that's not necessarily seen in tap. But again, 40 to 60% is tap water, but it is sold at a much higher markup than tap water.
I see. Now, getting back more to food and the health survey in general, we talked about how there are some specific problems. High blood pressure, diabetes is another. But here we're talking mainly about obesity now. And so let's talk a little bit about childhood experiences, Dr. Schrader. There's something known as the ACE score, the Adverse Childhood Experiences. NPR has been talking about that this past week. In other words, abuse, neglect, rough childhood experiences, and what effect they have on one's future and one's diet and obesity, I suppose.
It's a huge area of research, and I think it can, you can come at it from many different ways. You know, like one of the things in the article that talked about NPR was that there's concerns that early childhood experiences in a negative way impact brain development, especially frontal lobe development. Frontal lobe development is very, very much connected to our executive functioning and how we organize and plan and think about our decisions. So if that's being impacted, then as kids come in contact with things that are immediately gratifying, whether it's food or drugs or other substances, it would make it more difficult for them to control the urge to necessarily consume that. But there's also many other areas about the ACE scores that they're looking at, and that's questions about whether there's even epigenetic effects and whether there's one particular area looking at telomeres, which in a real rough way are kind of the ends of our chromosomes. And whether
telomeres
is some of the new areas. And that's still an early area of research, so we don't quite know what's going to develop there. But the question is whether or not that those childhood experiences repeatedly cause some damage to those telomeres there that may end up impacting cell growth. And that could ultimately affect, you know, cardiac, I mean, look at cardiac disease and other areas. So it's a big, big area of research, even related to stress and everything else. So,
yes, Dr. Dotavi, would you like to... Dovalatabadi, would you like to chime in on that?
I think Dr. Becker may be better able to chime in on that topic.
The idea of stress adding on to it, stress has large impacts on the body, and the better we can learn to overcome that, to think our way through it instead of reacting our way through it, just like we react to sweet sugar. And the same, not that sweet sugar is stressful, but... It might be if you have to stay away from it. The more we can understand ourselves and how to control our behaviors, the better off we're going to be.
All right. That's Dr. Laura Becker. She specializes in hormonal effects on behavior. Also joining us this hour, Dr. Patel Dovalatabadi. She's from the University of Evansville, specializing in nutrition, chronic disease prevention, and mental health. Also, Dr. James Schrader is with us. He's a pediatric psychologist here in Evansville. We'll take a short break. We'll also take your phone calls, 812-426-7400. That's the number to call here at WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. More of the discussion straight ahead on WNIN-FM.
Support comes from Tin Man Brewing Company, with live local music every Tuesday evening from 6 to 8, featuring sights and sound. On Tuesday, March 10th, Tin Man is located on West Franklin Street in Evansville and on the web at tinmanbrewing.com.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. Good afternoon. I'm John Gibson. We're discussing the 2015 Tri-State Health Survey that was recently released by the Wellburn Foundation. And particularly, we're talking about obesity today and all of the issues and problems involved with that. Well, let's go to a basic question, what to do with all of this information. We understand that obviously too many people are overweight and obese in the Tri-State. What are the steps we should take now that we have this information, this data in our hands?
Well, I think just to focus on parenting, we talked about early introduction of positive foods. We talked about really water should be our primary source of hydration there. We also have to look at the foods that are in our house as our kids are growing up. We know that although some of us may occasionally run down and get an ice cream or go get fast food, most of the times if you have a craving and it's not in the house, it's going to be more difficult and you're less likely to actually seek it out. Mm-hmm. So we really have to look at which foods that we have in our cabinets and discern, it's okay to have some snacks occasionally, to have a few available. But again, many families get in the habit where the cabinets are just full of snacks there. I think the other thing we have to consider is to look at food as not just something to kind of be a deterrent against, but also what can food do for us? And we really, even with my family and our kids, we promote the positive aspects of food and how that can help us feel better.
That's Dr. James Schrader. He's a pediatric psychologist. Also joining us today is Dr. Patel Dovla-Tabadi from the University of Evansville. Dr. Laura Becker is also with us. And I understand we have a caller. I believe it's Aaron. Are you on the air? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering about this, about the idea, what your guests think about this idea that our ideas towards healthy eating and healthy lifestyles are kind of culturally reinforced. So, like, for example, if you take Michelle Obama's, as probably is a huge proponent of healthy eating and healthy lifestyles. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes there's a derision or even a hostility towards this idea that why would I need to worry about healthy eating? That's for hipsters and university professors to worry about. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I guess my question is whether you think this is true, that this is kind of culturally reinforced, and second of all, what we can start to do about that
All right, we will ask our guests. We appreciate that call, Aaron. Thank you very much. We talked about this a little bit earlier about healthy eating, and you encourage healthy eating, and there might be some sort of blowback, I guess. Folks feel like you're trying to dictate to them what they can and cannot eat. When it comes to behavior, and I guess we can turn to Dr. Becker on that, is this an issue? Is that a problem, in terms of how people respond to these, this advice to eat more healthy?
Definitely, our eating habits are culturally based. They're based through our family. They're based through our friends. Every time we celebrate something in our society, we have food involved.
Right.
We have wedding cake. We have things for the baptismal. But the idea is those are treats. Those are special times. That's a special celebration. Simple things like having your kids get up and move away from, I know it's not popular, but the video game, mm-hmm. and move their bodies around, get on a bike and go ride down the street, move a little bit more, spend a little bit less time sitting in the house where the food is so available,
right.
Things like that.
Yeah, we haven't touched on fitness very much. We're talking a lot about good eating habits, but obviously fitness and activity are a very, very important part of it all, right?
Absolutely. It's very important to engage in that physical activity. And I'm not saying join a gym membership, right? If you can park a little farther away at the grocery store, take the elevator, take the stairs instead of the elevator, little steps like that can improve physical activity. And specifically with children, children are spending much more time playing video games and watching TV and not being physically active. And while they are watching TV, these commercials regarding sugary foods and drinks are being targeted towards the children. So it creates this urge for the children to consume these foods. So it's very important to get the children physically active as well.
And Dr. Schrader, I'm guessing physical activity, you're dealing with children. How important is it?
it's as important as it gets, honestly. I mean, it's something that we really do want to encourage again through our families early on. It's interesting that physical activity alone is increasingly being used as an intervention to treat depression and anxiety. So we know there's a great power in physical activity there. But as you mentioned earlier, sometimes there's a recoil, whether against giving up foods or having to move. And I think that's where we really have to, early on with our families, build in the possibilities, not just the obligations that are associated with these areas.
Now, we talked earlier about this survey. It comes out about once every 5 years. We have all this data. What should we do with this information from a public policy perspective? What would you folks like to see? How should the community act on this data? Who would like to take that one?
I think policy is a very important component. Good policy leads to better environments, leading to more healthier behaviors. So I would hope to see more pedestrian-friendly walkways, more bicycle-friendly pathways. It would be nice to see those living in poor socioeconomic areas that they have access to full-fledged grocery stores so they can access those fruits and vegetables. It would be nice to see parks and recreations built in those poor socioeconomic areas so that children do have access to more physical activity. So again, this really has to begin on a policy level so that we can create those healthier environments.
Of course, we have smoking bans, those kinds of things, which were unheard of not too many years ago. What are some of the other public policy things that could happen, Dr. Becker?
Well, I'd like to see that we reinforce and encourage play in schools, recreation. We say, we have too many pieces of information they need to learn, they need to be in the classroom. We see many pieces of research saying that exercise is fantastic for your brain growth and for your education. So not only do we help the activity level, we affect the intelligence level of the students too.
That's Dr. Laura Becker. She specializes in hormonal effects on behavior. Also joining us today, Dr. Patel Dovla-Tabadi from the University of Evansville. We're also speaking with Dr. James Schrader. He's a pediatric psychologist. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back with our closing minutes here on The Trend. I'm John Gibson. Stay with us. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. We're speaking about the Tri-State Health Survey and specifically obesity on today's program. And we're joined now by Dr. Don Rodd. Dr. Rodd, can you tell us essentially your area of expertise?
Well, I'm at the University of Evansville, and I'm an exercise physiologist, and I'm in the exercise science area.
All right. We were talking about fitness and how important it is. When we're dealing with obesity, how do we get more people active?
Well, we really need to have people active more for good health. There's some really great information from the panelists here, and really the key is the intake. And really the exercise for an obese individual or anyone is really for good health. The problem with exercise to try and lose weight is that you need such a high volume to lose weight. It's very difficult to do that. So really, the most effective approach is really to go on the intake side.
Right. And that sort of portion control, that kind of thing.
It is. And as you said, how do we encourage people? And if you go out and exercise for half an hour, walk around Wesselman Park, and you see no change, it's very discouraging. So we like to tell our clients to really exercise for good health.
And in the situation where someone is obese, we spoke earlier about folks who are morbid obese. You know, it may be so discouraging to them, but I'm guessing there are programs that can help lose those large amounts of weight.
Well, you're getting to really specialized area. if people are too morbidly obese, sometimes they have to do very minimal exercises because it's very dangerous for them to exercise.
Right.
A lot of these individuals can't carry their own body weight, so we have to be very careful. So they do very simple exercise and really gradually work to a basic exercise program. So those are the people really you're focusing on, right, dietary intake. But again, everyone needs to exercise for good health.
Talking about eating better and healthier foods, we discussed this a little bit earlier in the program. Healthy eating, there seems to be this perception, right or wrong, is that it's expensive, that a lot of folks feel they can't afford to buy healthier foods, that it's much quicker and easier to just pick up something at the nearby drive-thru for a couple of bucks. How do we address those issues of food costs and healthy food costs? And I'm not sure who would like to start with that one.
Professor Dalabadi, that's her specialized area.
Dalabadi, if you could discuss this.
Yes, definitely. Food prices are increasing, but consider the amount you would spend going through a drive-thru, $5. With that $5, you can buy a number of fruits and vegetables and make a salad for a meal. So again, there are equivalents that can be purchased. Mm-hmm. And if you're spending that much for breakfast, lunch, and dinner eating out, consider saving that money and buying healthier ingredients.
And of course, healthy ingredients, some folks would argue, well, that requires time to prepare and that kind of thing. So we're back to habits and behavior, I'm guessing. Right, Dr. Becker?
Yes. And when you want to change a habit or a behavior, you have to start slowly. So the same thing we've been talking about, slowly learn that you can throw some broccoli in the microwave and steam it quickly. And now you have a nice sweet, it's actually sweet, treat to eat on top of that. You don't have to spend the time boiling or putting it in a casserole.
Before we wrap up here today, obesity has also been talked about its effect on many things, not the least of which is increased healthcare costs, because obviously there's a lot of healthcare involved. And also NPR recently has been reporting on back injuries for nurses who've had to deal with, heavier patients and that kind of thing. Is that a factor that we see in this area in terms of, the impact on healthcare workers? Anyone want to touch on that?
Definitely. Healthcare professionals are handling more obese cases on a daily basis, and therefore they are experiencing a number of adverse health outcomes as well. And just going back to mentioning that those who are obese, it's very, very important that they do engage in this daily behavioral change. It does have a severe economic impact. It has a severe impact personally, and it can impact others as well.
Dr. Schrader, as a pediatric psychologist, do you consider obesity a mental health issue?
It certainly has become, and as you mentioned before, I think the relationship is bidirectional. So it is. And we've seen some recent studies actually in the last couple of years that look at intake again of sodas and junk food in young kids. And irrespective of any other factors, it's associated with increased behavioral attention and even mood issues. So it is a mental health issue.
All right. Any final comments, Dr. Becker? Would you like to chime in on that?
Well, it all starts, like we've been saying, with home and everyone surrounding the children. So the availability of good food in the schools, the reduction in the amount of soda machines and candy machines, and the encouragement of movement.
Yes. And Dr. Dalabadi, as far as obesity being a mental health issue, is that the way you see it as well?
Yes, definitely. There is a significant mental health component to obesity, and therefore, just going back to what Dr. Becker said, behavioral change needs to be made in order to improve this crisis.
Dr. Rod, are you optimistic that we can shift this tide in terms of healthy eating, losing weight, that kind of thing?
I think we can. I think there's a lot of good information that was shared here, and I think a real key, a real exciting area now is how the gut microbes are interacting with foods. And one of the panelists had mentioned all the processed food we have, and an area that's being explored now is how the gut bacteria is interacting. And that's a whole different area. They're now releasing different hormones, encouraging obesity. So that's a very, very exciting area.
All right. That's Dr. Don Rudd. We appreciate you. Don Rod, I'm sorry. Appreciate you joining us today. Dr. Apeyo Dalabadi from the University of Evansville, thank you so much. Also, Dr. Laura Becker and Dr. James Schrader. We appreciate you joining the discussion. Also, thanks to our earlier guest, Elizabeth Tharp from the Wellburn Baptist Foundation. I'm John Gibson. This is The Trend. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. Thank you for joining us.